Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a website designer could deny her services to same-sex couples because of her religious objections. We'll talk to a law and LGBT rights expert about the case and what it means for First Amendment protections and discrimination laws. First, this is a popular time of year for motorcycle trips here in Wisconsin. And it's a great time to make sure that the roads are as safe as possible for those trips. Wisconsin is the sixth most dangerous state for motorcyclists to drive in. That's according to a study this year using National Highway Traffic Safety Administration data. Nearly 15% of all fatal crashes in Wisconsin involve motorcycles. And this year, the State Department of Transportation says fatal motorcycle crashes are up nearly a third compared to last year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you ride a motorcycle, what do you do to stay safe? Do you have a message for other road users, things that worry you when you're on the road? Are you noticing more dangerous motorcycling conditions in your area? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick Jarmus is a public affairs director for AAA. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
I know numbers can go up and down with things like traffic fatalities. What have you been seeing in recent years, Nick, when it comes to motorcycle safety in Wisconsin?
Well, not just motorcycle safety, but we've been seeing a lot of very troubling trends with traffic safety across the board, particularly with more vulnerable road users like pedestrians and cyclists. And I would put motorcyclists in that category as well, because, you know, you're a road user that doesn't have the protection of the vehicle and the crash protections of a passenger vehicle around them. So that does leave them more vulnerable to injuries and fatalities when crashes occur.
One study we saw here, this was published in Forbes, says that a third of all motorcycle accidents involve riders without a valid license. Now, that's nationwide. Can you talk about, why motorcyclists have their own unique special licenses, the kind of training that goes into a two-wheeled vehicle on the roads as opposed to the four-wheeled kind?
Well, there are certainly, traffic laws that apply to everyone, regardless of what mode of transportation you're using, if you're a cyclist or a motorcyclist or a automobile driver, there are specific laws, specific rules and tips that need to be kept in mind when you're, a cyclist or a motorcycle rider, because you're more vulnerable to injuries and fatalities when crashes occur. There are certain things that you need to know, but that certainly doesn't mean that this is a conversation that is just of concern to motorcycle riders. I mean, everyone who's on the road has a shared responsibility to make sure that everyone else is safe and that they are not endangering anyone else. So auto drivers also need to be taking responsibility for, other people that are sharing the road with them and recognizing that they have, sort of a disproportionate responsibility, because if they were to make a mistake that injures a motorcyclist or a bicyclist or a pedestrian, there's a greater chance that that's going to lead to greater injuries. And so you have to watch out for them, and pay special mind for them.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. The all the other road users, what kind of things do we need to be aware of to make sure that our, fellow road users on motorcycles are safe, that we don't endanger them through our actions?
Well, certainly, the basic things like staying focused on the road, not being distracted by your smartphone or anything else inside or outside of the vehicle. As the driver, you have to take responsibility and manage what's happening on the road. One of the really troubling things that we see is as more and more passenger vehicles are getting equipped with advanced driver safety systems, the auto braking or lane keeping assists or things like that, there is a danger for people to develop a false sense of security and over-rely on those systems and not have a full appreciation for the limitations of those systems. We've done a lot of studies that show what those limitations are, and it's not for the purpose of discouraging, the development or discouraging the requirements, to implement these systems. But just so that people understand, particularly, we haven't looked at motorcyclists specifically, but we have looked at bicyclists and pedestrians. And we know that the sensors that these automatic backup alarms or lane keeping assistance, alerts are not, just simply not able to capture pedestrians and cyclists. So, you know, you may move into a lane and it doesn't alert you that there's a motorcyclist in the next lane because that's not a big enough vehicle to trigger the alarm. And so you need to be aware of that, that this is a secondary safety system. And you as the driver still have the primary responsibility to visually check those lanes, visually be scanning yourself and not relying on the sensors.
So that basic driver's ed thing we got, check your blind spot before the lane change, still applies even if we have that blind spot warning device in the car.
Absolutely. And you know, the other kind of thing that we have a lot of concerns, and I know a lot in the cycling community have concern about, are, you know, just the increasing size and weight issues with passenger vehicles today. They're, you know, especially electric, EVs are much heavier. And then you have, you know, the continued popularity of pickup trucks and SUVs that have higher hoods on them, and which actually put pedestrians or people at a greater risk because the sight lines are different or limited. You're not able to see things that are maybe right in front of you. And then the weight of the vehicle is disproportionately higher in a position where it's going to cause more damage to a cyclist or a motorcyclist.
Talking to Nick Jarmus with AAA, looking at motorcycle safety in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your personal experiences, your thoughts, your questions about motorcycle safety, what we can all do to help. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Scott is with us in Plymouth. Scott, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Great conversation. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to give a little bit of history. I'm 55. I've probably been riding motorcycles for 40 plus of those years. Motocross, street bikes, scooters, electric vehicles, etc. To tell the truth, my biggest fear and the biggest thing I've noticed probably within the last decade is distracted driving. It's to the point where having people wander over the center line because they're looking at their phones, that scares me more than anything, to the point I want to not ride anymore. Being an older gentleman as well, I always wear my safety gear. I've taken safety courses, which I think a lot of people should do. And as your guest brought up, distracted driving, I think it personally is a huge, huge thing. And on, just to tag on to that a little bit, some of the people, if they aren't taking safety courses, they should try to get a vehicle that they can control. Something big like a Harley Davidson for somebody who's very small, I think is very physically demanding and hard to control when you have to do something. Thanks for taking my call. I'll take it off here.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. Nick, Scott gave us two big topic areas there. You had touched on this already a bit. Distracted driving as a threat, Scott says, that he's seen grow over the years as a longtime motorcyclist. You at AAA, I know, are very concerned about distracted driving these days.
Yeah, it's been a high, you know, topic for a high priority topic for us for a long time. We've done a lot of research in the last decade to try and understand it better and to try and figure out what's the best way to address it. And the thing is, it's a really insidious problem because it's difficult to track. It's difficult to quantify and monitor. You know, it's not like with drug or alcohol impairment where you can administer a blood test, you know, in the event of a crash and find out, okay, was the driver, you know, did they have drugs or alcohol in their system? With distraction, there's no way of knowing. You kind of have to piece it together through clues to figure out. But there's just also a lot of misunderstanding of how much of a distraction or what tasks really cause dangerous levels of distraction. We hear a lot of people, you know, say, well, I would never text. I would never be like reading, you know, looking at my phone or scrolling through my phone. Or you even hear about, you know, handheld phone versus, you know, put it on speaker. But most of the research that's out there shows even speakerphone conversations can be dangerously distracting. And it causes a phenomenon known as inattention blindness, where even though your hands are on the wheel, even though your eyes are straight ahead and are theoretically seeing things, your brain is not processing those things because it is distracted by the conversation. And then because it's not processing those things, you're not able to react to them.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. I think our next caller may touch a little on Scott's second point, too, on safety. Matt joins us in Stevens Point. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
I've been an avid motorcycle rider for about 30 years, since I was a pretty young kid. And 20 years ago, I was involved in an accident and from a distracted driver in a construction zone. And it wasn't fun, and I'm glad that I lived through it. And what I took away from it and my fellow ride or friends that ride with me is just assume that everyone else on the road doesn't see you, that they do not know that you're there at all times, that as a motorcycle rider, you need to drive very defensively when you're going down the road, and just assume that they don't see you.
I gotcha. Matt, I'm glad you survived it too. Thank you so much for calling in. Nick, that kind of extra defensive driving on a motorcycle.
Yeah, that idea of defensive driving is key, because, you know, we know no matter how safe of a driver you may be, you still also can be affected by the mistakes of others. And so being able to anticipate those, you know, being conscious of what other drivers on the road are doing. If you see a driver that's sharing the road with you is distracted or seems to possibly be impaired or something, knowing what to do. And usually the best thing to do is to slow down, move out of their way, let them pass by, so that you keep them in front of you and you can monitor what they're doing instead of you having to worry about what they're doing behind you. But that's, of course, not always possible. And certainly that still leaves that person on the road to cause, risk to other people. You know, if you are able to pull safely off the side of the road, call emergency authorities, give them your location and a description of the vehicle, and see if they can dispatch someone to try and get that driver off the road. That's ideal, because that's going to keep everyone safe.
Thanks a lot for that call, Matt. We're talking to Nick Jarmus, Public Affairs Director for AAA. We're talking about motorcycle safety, what bikers need to know, and all the other road users need to know to keep everybody safe. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you ride a motorcycle yourself, what are some of the riskiest things you see out there? Are you getting out on your bike a lot this year? Have you seen things change over the last few years when it comes to safety and attentive driving? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Nick Jarmus, Public Affairs Director at AAA. We're looking into a rise in Wisconsin motorcycle fatalities this year and how to stay safe on the road. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Do you wear helmets when on a motorcycle? How can the state better protect bikers on the road? Join in with your thoughts, experiences, or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Marinette. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm 63, had a license since I was 17. One accident, broke 26 bones, was brought by an elderly gentleman. Otherwise, pretty good record. Just wanted to say, people, to add on to what another guy said on your show, people should drive like, pretend like you're invisible. Like, nobody can even see you. A mentor of mine told me that, and to me it works.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, we've had a few comments from motorcyclists now on how to ride safely and defensively. And Scott, our first call, mentioned safety training. Now, what kind of things go into safety training for those motorcyclists? Are there things that we could do to enhance that training?
Well, certainly, I mean, there are the drivers or rider safety courses that are offered through DOT, the Wisconsin Motorcycle Safety Program. We recommend everyone go through those, making sure, and you referenced at the top, the percentage of these fatalities that involve a driver who is not properly licensed. And that really, is, again, an issue that cuts across everyone. I mean, we know that there's a certain percentage of all crashes that involve non-licensed drivers or drivers at least who have had their license revoked. And that proper training, proper preparation is really key for anyone that's going to be out on the road, even cyclists, even pedestrians. If you're going to be in that roadway environment, you need to know what your individual responsibilities are, how to keep yourself safe as well as how to keep other people safe. And it's that's really what I would want to stress more than anything, is that shared sense of responsibility. Because a lot of drivers, you know, maybe dismiss like, well, if you're on a motorcyclist, you're taking that risk on, and that's on you. And that's really not the right way to look at it. Everyone needs to be watching out for themselves as well as watching out for everyone else, because we all just want to get home. And everyone that's on the road is a friend or a family member of someone out there, and you know, an important life that needs to be preserved and protected on the road.
Jim, thanks for the call. Chris is with us now in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to say how I drive like about 25,000 miles a year, and I don't know how valid this is, but there seems to be this perception that like motorcycle drivers tend to be kind of aggressive, and I've kind of, it's probably confirmation bias, but I was kind of just wondering, you know, as far as that whole, you know, stereotype goes, what is that warranted? You know, are there statistics on that and so on and so forth? And that's pretty much all I was asking.
Hey, Chris, I want to ask you, it sounds like, if that's a stereotype out there, you don't see yourself that way. You don't see yourself as a aggressive risk taking kind of motorcyclist. Do I have that right?
No, I'm not a motorcyclist. I just drive a car to work.
Oh, car. I
commute 50 miles one way. Yeah. And, I think everybody's seen, you know, that guy on a motorcycle that like, you know, whizzes past or like rides you. And, you know, I'm open-minded. I think maybe that's just confirmation bias. But I was just wondering, does anybody have the facts?
Gotcha. Chris, thanks for the call. Nick, anything to suggest that motorcyclists are any more aggressive as drivers than other drivers?
No, I do think that's more of a perception thing. And I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but, you know, we do know that motorcyclists and other vulnerable roadway users are disproportionately overrepresented in crash fatalities, but that's largely a function of the fact that they're less protected by, you know, the vehicle around them, and that's why they are vulnerable roadway users. I don't necessarily think it's the case that motorcyclists are involved in a disproportionate number of crashes generally. It's just that when those crashes occur, they tend to be more injury causing for them. So I think that is more of a perception thing. And we know most motorcyclists are not primarily motorcyclists. They also are drivers. Same thing with cyclists and pedestrians. You know, most people are multimodal to some extent. They're never using one mode of transportation exclusively 100% of the time. And so everyone needs to, you know, remember that, you know, the cyclists and motorcyclists that are out there have every right to be out there as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Nick Jarmus from AAA about motorcycle safety in a peak motorcycle season this time of year. Back to your calls. Nick is with us in Madison. Nick, hi.
Hi. I've been commuting and driving for my careers forever, and so I see a lot of stuff on the road. And I just got to say, you know, motorcycle, obviously you don't have the protection of a car, and people choose not to wear a helmet, whatever. And there are some bad drivers out there, and worse. So I think, you know, just one point is, it's, you know, it's a dangerous thing. I mean, anyway, another point is, I've seen, you know, in the Beltline, back up on the Beltline in the morning, you know, little crotch rockets and whatnot shooting up in between, you know, the two lanes. So I think, you know, motorcycles got to police their own also.
Gotcha. We don't have a ton of time left. Nick Jarmus, first of all, that last thing he mentioned, when motorcycles go through that stopped traffic on, say, a highway somewhere, I think that's legal, but correct me if I'm wrong.
You know, I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
It is legal in some jurisdictions, you know, not legal in others. It does present a lot of risk. And so, you know, this is just kind of a general statement as well. Just because something is legal or is not illegal doesn't make it a safe and smart thing to do. And so, I mean, I think I would discourage motorcyclists from doing that, even if it were legal, just for a number of reasons. But that is a complaint that we do hear often, that is a unnecessary risk.
Thanks for that call. I'm looking, Nick, at a stat here. About a quarter of motorcycle accident deaths, this is nationwide here, in the last couple of years involved alcohol. Now, that could be the motorcyclist. It could be another driver in a collision. May seem obvious, but avoiding alcohol while driving, still a big deal for all users.
That's right. And that's actually about on par with what, you know, all roadway crashes involve. You know, about a third of them actually involve alcohol to some extent. So no matter what mode of transportation you're using, just don't get behind the wheel if you're impaired. You know, even if you've had a little bit of drinks. And Wisconsin is great in the sense there are a lot of alternatives out there. You know, we have the Safe Ride program. We offer our Tow2Go program during key holiday weekends. There's a lot of other ways that you can get home. There's really no excuse for ever getting on your bike or behind the wheel if you are impaired.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Nick Jarmus, Director of Public Affairs for AAA. You can keep the conversation about motorcycle safety going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you are seeing out there on the road, whatever you're driving, what you do to try to keep motorcyclists and others safe while you're out on the road. Again, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, a law professor who studies LGBT rights joins us for a look at the impact of a new U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allowed a website designer to deny her services to same-sex couples getting married that's based on her religious beliefs. We'll find out what went into that ruling, what it means for a lot of lines of work in the United States, and as always, you can join in with your thoughts. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an artist helps us explore our familiar environments to find emotional and artistic inspiration. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled at the end of last month that a Colorado-based website designer could deny her services to same-sex couples seeking a wedding website. The designer said her religious beliefs opposed same-sex marriage. The court's majority ruled that her work is a form of free speech and that Colorado anti-discrimination laws can't force her into speech that would, quote, defy her conscience about a matter of major significance. The majority opinion in the case said that the same protections would apply to other businesses that provide a service involving a form of speech or expression. Opponents say that the ruling will embolden other businesses to discriminate against LGBT community members and claim free speech protections. The case has raised big questions about who and what the First Amendment protects and where the line is between free speech and discrimination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this Supreme Court case? What do you make of the ruling? Do you think they got it right? What questions do you have about this case, the First Amendment, discrimination laws? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Craig Conniff is the Martha Lubin Karsh and Bruce A. Karsh Bicentennial Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, where he studies health law, constitutional law, and LGBT rights. He was formerly the Deputy Solicitor General for the state of California. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here, Rob.
Now, I gave a very short summary of this case, cases that go to the Supreme Court. There's a lot of tangles and loops leading along the way. Can you give us some of the background of what brought this to the nation's highest court?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, a few years ago, a graphic designer, Lori Smith, who built websites but did not build wedding websites, said that she wanted to build wedding websites, but she also wanted to post a notice saying that she would not make wedding websites for same-sex couples. She filed a case in district court. The district court said, well, you've got to actually have a case for. Someone has to come to you, say that they want a wedding website. You have to be prosecuted in some way. There has to be a case where you are somehow being targeted for not serving same-sex couples. So you basically lose on what lawyers call standing. You have no standing to bring the case until you actually suffer some kind of burden. In the Tenth Circuit, the Court of Appeals held, well, actually, she does have standing. She can bring the case because there's a good chance she will be prosecuted because the law prevents her from posting that she won't serve same-sex couples, but that she loses on the merits, that actually the law can require her to serve same-sex couples for their wedding websites on an equal basis as different-sex couples. And then finally, she asked the Supreme Court to review the case, and the Supreme Court basically held, as you said, that she had a First Amendment right to violate the Colorado anti-discrimination law in question here.
What kind of precedent do you think this case sets now for, I mean, this one was specific to a website designer who's going to do wedding websites. What other things could this ruling open the door to?
So there are two possible ways this case may go, right? So one way in which some commentators have treated this case is that it's very narrow. What the Colorado Attorney General did in the lower courts is that they agreed that building a website is expressive speech, basically. And so right in the first couple of pages of the opinion, Justice Gorsuch, who's writing for the court, says the parties agreed that this is protected speech. And so therefore, our ruling rests on that fact. In other cases, the parties may not agree that the speech is actually protected. So there was a prior case involving a baker, as you may recall, and the baker said baking a cake is a form of expression and should be protected. And so you can sort of see people disputing what exactly is protected speech or not. If the ruling is narrow, then we may only see this play a role when it comes to sort of building a website, or printing wedding invitations, or maybe photography, but, you know, potentially not much further. People like me who are maybe a little more pessimistic as you look at the way the Supreme Court's behaved over the last few years, think that this is going to sweep more broadly, that you are going to have florists and bakers and others also say, well, this is expression, and lower courts agreeing with them. But that has to do with what people are doing, making cakes, etc. The second question is, whom will they be able to discriminate against? So here we're talking about same-sex couples, same-sex weddings. But really, there's nothing in the opinion that prevents someone from coming in tomorrow and saying, well, I object to interracial weddings. And while I have nothing against black people, I object to their marriage white people, and so I will not make a wedding website for interracial weddings. So this has the potential to sweep quite broadly. Even beyond discrimination, this has the potential to, you know, so someone believes that they have to, you know, you've got to build a website in complying with various other laws or regulations, or you've got to, you know, prepare documents that comply with, you know, reports that are set by safety agencies that the state says, and an organization comes in and says, well, actually, this violates our First Amendment rights. And it's quite unclear what courts will do, because if this is expressive speech, then the limit is very, very porous.
Now, we've looked at the majority opinion here saying, in effect, hey, we think this Colorado law would be compelling this person to make speech that they creative expression that they don't agree with. The dissent here made the case that the three justices who voted against this ruling said you're legalizing discrimination against certain people who are doing something legal, getting married. Could you talk a little more about what we heard from the three justices who dissented from the opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there were, you know, various elements to this, but I think the key point for me that I took away was the dissent saying, look, our previous precedent. So there is an important precedent here where you have law schools, you know, back in when the military discriminated against people. A law school said we don't want the military recruiting on our campuses because that basically forces us into, you know, circulating emails on behalf of the military who are recruiting, and we are basically then engaging in speech that we don't want to engage in on behalf of an anti-gay organization, that is the U.S. military at that point. And the Supreme Court said, well, it's not your speech, it's the U.S. military speech. And so similarly, the dissent relied on that and said, look, in this case, Laurie Smith is not speaking on behalf of herself. She's speaking on behalf of the couple that's getting married. And you can see this analogy in other contexts, right? So the spokesperson for the White House isn't speaking on behalf of him or herself. He or she is speaking on behalf of the White House. So similarly here, it is not the speech of the designer, and therefore she does not get to claim First Amendment protections. I think more broadly, though, it's generally been accepted that these kinds of public accommodation laws serve important government interests. And so even if they incidentally burden the speech of certain groups or certain organizations, the importance of people being able to go into stores, go into hospitals, go into institutions where they can feel safe and get served, that's generally been acknowledged to be an important enough interest that that the incidental burdens of speech have been accepted. And the Supreme Court is undoing that framework.
Talking to Craig Conneth with the law school at the University of Virginia, looking at this U.S. Supreme Court ruling saying a web designer could start a business selling wedding websites, creating wedding websites, and could say, hey, yeah, only opposite sex couples, only men and women, no same sex couples. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your reactions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hi.
Good afternoon. Obviously, this is the wedding cake case redo, and before a radically different Supreme Court. What has really disturbed me, though, is learning that apparently they completely fabricated any defendants in the case. In other words, nobody had approached the plaintiff to ask for a wedding page, or if they had, it was fraudulent. But either way, it's entirely possible, maybe probable, that the plaintiff swore to this under oath.
Randy, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Randy. Craig, Randy referred to, I think the original reporting was from the New Republic, who tracked down in an earlier part of this case, the plaintiff had said, hey, I received via my web thing a request from a same-sex couple. The New Republic tracked it down with identifying information. Doesn't appear that that happened. That part was discarded from the case along the way. A lot of people made a lot of it. How big a deal is that?
You know, to be honest, it's not really that big a deal from a legal perspective. I mean, I think that from a political and a political perspective, and just, you know, trying to get a sense of how these cases are manufactured and what anti-LGBT rights advocates are doing, I think it's important to see what methods are being deployed. But from the legal perspective here, it doesn't make much of a difference because the courts basically said, you know, look, she wants to post this notice that she won't serve same-sex couples. And her desire to post the notice is they portrayed it, and I believe is independent of whether she was, she was asked to make a website for the same-sex couples. So from a legal perspective, it doesn't play that much of a role.
Thanks for the call, Randy. But how about you touched on this earlier, Craig? The standing ruling. Some observers said, "Hey, wait a minute. You know, she should have started the wedding website." You mentioned this earlier. Been challenged, been targeted under this law. Then there's a case here. There is still some argument out there, I think, about standing. Is that right?
Yeah, to my mind, there is, because she has to show that there is some kind of clear danger that the law will be enforced against her. And there really, you know, there really wasn't. I mean, the Supreme Court said, well, the Colorado Attorney General hasn't disavowed. They haven't said that they will not prosecute her. I think it's very strange to ask a public entity to do that. But if you look at the Supreme Court's past cases, I mean, you have people who've been stopped and frisked by the police, a hundred times or more within a couple of months, and the Supreme Court has said, "Oh, you don't have standing to come sue the police for prospective, stops and frisks." But in this case, you have someone, who wants to post something that is true, but it really does seem that that this stretches standing doctrine, beyond anything that we've seen before.
Thanks again for that call, Randy. We're talking to University of Virginia law professor Craig Conneth about the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allowed a website designer to deny services to same-sex couples seeking wedding websites because of her religious beliefs. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that decision? The right call, the wrong call? What other creative type jobs do you think should be covered under this ruling, should be able to deny services to someone based on beliefs? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Craig Conneth, law professor and LGBT rights expert from the University of Virginia. And we're looking at a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that allowed a Colorado website designer to say she would deny services to same-sex couples seeking a wedding website, citing religious objections. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that ruling, your questions about it. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm disturbed by this decision also. Number one, as I remember, New York State law, I just moved from there recently. Their actual marriage law for gay couples was a civil union law. In other words, they provided, you know, mercy issues, covered mercy issues like visiting in the hospital and contact, you know, institutional issues. You know, for the Catholic Church, marriage is a sacrament. So I think you really have to kind of maybe dig deeper into any state differences between civil union versus marriage.
Okay, I gotcha. And Craig, so before that big Supreme Court ruling legalized same-sex marriage nationwide, this was a debate in a lot of states, you know, full marriage equality, civil unions as an alternative for same-sex couples. I believe that whole civil union thing is just, under the latest from the Supreme Court, is not a part of the story anymore. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's really not part of the story anymore, because after 2015, marriage equality was mandated across the nation. So that really doesn't sort of become part of the conversation today.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dan in Madison. Dan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to say that I think things have to be kept in perspective, that this is not a person who is trying to run a small business, because I know this for a fact, because to have these types of lawsuits costs many, many hundreds, if not millions of dollars. So somebody who's trying to start a business running a website, it's not funding this, number one. And number two, any rational business person that's trying to start a business would never turn away any type of couple who's going to pay for you to do a website, especially when you're starting out. So this is just part of the cultural wars and the war on gay people, which is really kind of a sad state of affairs. That's really all I had to say.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. And Craig, there were groups, national groups involved in this that as Dan was suggesting, kind of viewed this as a test case that they were out looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is clearly a case that was sought out. One of the issues in the Cake case that went up to the Supreme Court that one of the previous callers and I alluded to earlier was whether baking a cake really constituted expression. And during the oral argument in that case, Justice Kagan raised that question. She said, you know, what becomes speech next? I mean, does a fancy restaurant menu that's made by a Michelin-starred chef, does that become speech? What about a makeup artist? As she said at oral argument, artist isn't the name of makeup artist. So does that become speech? So I think that, you know, many of the folks who wanted to target these anti-discrimination laws and who wanted to target equality for same-sex couples, they sort of went around looking for cases that would be better. Now, some people have accused the lawyers here of manufacturing the case. Some people have suggested that they manufactured the request that turned out to be fake that was sent to Lori Smith, the website designer in this case. And then, as you said, the New Republic found out that the request was fake. There's no evidence that they manufactured it, but basically, I think that this case was the sort of ideal case for them. And then, of course, the fact got stipulated that this is expressive speech, that made it even better. But beyond that, I think that this becomes the wedge in the door, right? Because you've got a website designer. The next time you'll have a photographer, right? And then you can just sort of keep going, a floral designer, and you can just keep going thinking about, more and more attenuated ways to express yourself and opening the doors, wider and wider to discrimination.
Dan, thanks for that call. Keith joins us now in Spring Green. Keith, hi.
Yes, thank you. It's my understanding that personal bias would be discrimination, that religious belief would be free speech. I'm wondering if the legal system and the court, if they have any sort of questions or filter to decide whether somebody really has that religious belief or whether they just take the person's word.
Interesting, Keith. Thanks for the call. Craig, is there a way that the court was trying to split that hair between bias versus genuine religious belief?
Not at all. I mean, I think that that's a really interesting question, because I think that, you kind of see the court in various other cases trying to figure out, when it comes to other groups, was this person really discriminated against because, they're Black, or because, they're, they're gay, et cetera. But here, and especially in the cake shop case, the court's really open to claims that someone's being discriminated against because of their religion. Now, I want to make it clear that this case is a free speech case, mm-hmm. right? But in all of these cases, when they're filed in district court, there's always this religion element. There's always a free exercise element that the anti-discrimination law is harming them because of their religion, right? And the court's precedent hasn't quite gone far enough to say that you can simply ignore the law because of your religious beliefs, at least when it comes to a state law. So I think that you do have some religion playing a role, but not explicitly. I just want to take a quick step back, though. So basically, there's a federal statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that basically says that when it comes to federal statutes, people have a religious right to disregard certain federal statutes if their religion prohibits them from doing so. And the court's been really sympathetic to those claims. So just recently, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the Title VII, which is the federal anti-discrimination law, has to give way to people's religious beliefs. People can say, I have a religious belief and I can discriminate against whoever I want because of my religious belief. So federal law is already under attack in that way. And I think it's just a matter of time before people sort of turn to state laws and say, well, actually, the Constitution, my free exercise of religion rights under the Constitution allow me to do what I want. And then finally, one last thought is that the court basically takes people at their word, right? So some of you may remember the Hobby Lobby case, which basically prohibited the Obama administration from requiring employers to distribute contraceptives. The employer in that case came in and said, look, we have a religious objection to distributing contraceptives. It violates our religion. And the Supreme Court said, okay, you don't have to. What's interesting is that same employer used to distribute contraceptives before Obamacare was law. The insurance programs that they signed up to, they distributed contraceptives. Suddenly they decided that it was against their religion, and the Supreme Court did not question that. So yeah, the Supreme Court really allows pretty much free rein when it comes to religious claims. To some degree, I think that's fair, but sometimes it can be quite problematic.
Keith, thanks for that call. And Craig, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
That's Craig Conniff, the Martha Lubin Karsh and Bruce A. Karsh Bicentennial Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, where he studies health law, constitutional law, and LGBT rights. He was with us today to discuss a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. This came out late last month. It allowed a business owner to deny services to same-sex couples over religious views and free speech rights. A lot of big U.S. Supreme Court rulings coming out over that last stretch of their term. Check out the archives at WPR.org for a lot of up-close looks at what went into them, what came out of them, what they mean, and there's still more to come. We're kind of playing catch-up. A lot came out over that last couple of weeks. Here's a Food Friday follow-up. Last Friday, I talked to grilling expert Meathead about making chicken on the grill. Well, you know, I'm very suggestible when it comes to food, so no surprise, yesterday I grilled some chicken, a couple boneless, skinless chicken breasts, and some bone-in, skin-on thighs. I did it just like Meathead said, all the coals on one side, baked the chicken on the no-coals side. When it's close to cook through, I seared it on the hot side. It came out really good. My marinade was olive oil, red wine vinegar, salt, pepper, garlic powder, and some sweet paprika. Side dish, some grilled eggplant skewers. Plus, my wife made me a foil pack with onions and capers to put on top of everything. I get a lot out of Food Friday. How about you? Have you ever cooked a meal inspired by a Food Friday? We want to know about it. If so, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Food Monday, this is Central Time.